Okay, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure being here this week. I've been here a few times before when it was more or less like a regular conference here. So for me, it's the first time to be here when it's really a working week, and I'm very much looking forward to this. So it's a pleasure to tell you about some of our work. In doing so, I will take a little bit my inspiration from Paul yesterday, is that also there's quite a few people in the audience that I don't know, so I don't really know what your specific backgrounds are. So I'll try to keep some of the aspects that I'll explain quite tutorial-like. Please tell me if I'm going too fast. Also, please wave me impatiently if I'm going too slowly. So what I'm going to be talking about is Otto second time resolved molecular electron dynamics. And that are actually the first question that one should ask oneself there is why one would be interested in something like the application of Otto second pulses to molecular science. In a sense, it's not immediately obvious that this is going to be interesting to do. I think many of you are well aware, certainly also many femtochemistry experiments have shown this very clearly, that the typical timescale for chemical processes, typical timescale for molecular rearrangement, is in the femtosecond timescale, and something like 5 or 10 femtoseconds is already very, very fast for a chemical process. And so in that sense, it's not immediately obvious that you would want to bring your Otto second tools to look at molecular systems. What I will try to convince you of, however, today is that there nevertheless are some real interesting reasons to do so. The first of these is that any time that we perform a femtochemistry experiment, any time that we perform a photochemistry experiment, look at a light-induced molecular process, then basically we are looking at a process that starts with an excitation of the electronic degrees of freedom, that is then rapidly followed or accompanied by a motion of the a change in the molecular structure. So that basically means that very early on, there must be a coupling of these electronic degrees of freedom that we are exciting with our optical excitation and the nuclear degrees of freedom that eventually then correspond to the molecular rearrangement. And what I'll show you is that this coupling, in certain cases, can be very, very fast, can be on the Otto second to few femtosecond timescales. Now, then there is the fact that many times that we excite molecules with light, we are actually with the light not talking just to single electrons, but we are sensitive to couplings between multiple electronic degrees of freedom in the molecule. And I'll also show you an example of that in my talk today, where such a coupling on the Otto second timescale turns out to be very important for understanding the final outcome of the experiment. Now, and then finally, there's a lot of excitement in the Otto second community right now, based on some predictions that suggest that studying molecular dynamics on Otto second to few femtosecond timescale may open up new opportunities to control chemical processes. Now, and that is something that at the moment is really driving a lot of the research in many of the groups in the field. So let me show you a little bit, what is behind this concept. Much of it goes back to experiments that were done in Munich about 20 years ago in the group of Ed Schlag and especially Rainer Weinkauf was the researcher doing these experiments. And what Rainer did at the time were very simple experiments. He took various dipeptides, so little biomolecules. I'll not go into the structure or the functionality of these molecules, but basically little biomolecular units with one property that was prepared ahead of time, in the sense that all of these molecules contained a chromophore which really localized the place where the light could be absorbed. And so in particular, what was done in these experiments, these biomolecules, they were ionized, and the idea was that this ionization process, because of the properties of the chromophore, were then really localized in specific parts of the molecule. That's basically what's indicated by this R here. Now, and then what was done in the experiment is basically that people did a simple mass spectrometry experiment. And so they basically looked at what kind of ionic species are detectable. Typically, the parent ion will be among them, but they also saw various fragments. Now, and here you see some of these mass spectra that were measured for some of the combination of molecules that you see on the left. And in all of these spectra, you see a very prominent peak here at mass 86. Now, and if you then look at your molecular structure, you realize that these are ionization processes where it's this group here on the left that carries the charge the moment that the molecule falls apart. Now, that was a really big surprise, in the sense that here, apparently, one has a process where the initial ionization process is really localized here. Nevertheless, when the molecule falls apart, and when you measure where is the charge, where is the positive charge, it turns out to be quite some distance removed from this. And this was seen in many, many molecules, and remarkably, the efficiency of this process seemed not to depend too much on how many functional groups were in between this point where the excitation took place and the point where finally the fragment was being formed. Now, and that's why people started thinking that they were not just looking at a traditional electron transfer process here, but something very special was going on here. And so this is basically where the idea was first came up, that what might be happening here is an ultra-fast migration of the charge from here to there on a timescale preceding any nuclear motion. And so basically on the few femtosecond timescale. And so basically when ultrasecond pulses came around in the early 2000s, there were several theoreticians who basically with these ideas in mind, or with these experiments in mind, started thinking about what one might be able to do with ultrasecond pulses in molecules, and how one might be able to exploit such a charge migration process, and under which conditions one might be able to excite it, and how one might then be able to exploit it. And one of the people who's been very active in this field has been Lenz Sederbaum, and here you see one of the calculations that Lenz and his co-worker Alexander Kulev have done already a few years ago, basically a prediction for what will happen in a particular conformer of the glycine molecule here the moment that you ionize the molecule with an ultrasecond pulse. And what you see here is a little movie where here at t equals zero, the ultrasecond pulse removes an electron from this part of the molecule, and you see that really in a few femtoseconds time, a substantial part of a fraction of the charge is on the other end of the molecule. So certainly on the time scale, that's much faster than how fast the nuclear degrees of freedom can react. And so this is something that many of the
others... Mark, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Does it mean it's localized there, or it's coherently excited and swings back and forth the electron distribution? Because relaxation, I guess, takes much longer to localize the charge.
I mean, in this very simple, this initial calculation, there was no relaxation included. So in that sense, you would predict that it just oscillates back and forth. Of course, one thing that people are beginning to work on in the last few years is the coupling to the nuclear degrees of freedom and how indeed it may lead to a localization. But you're right, the time scale for that process basically is then given by the time scale of the coupling, and typically it will be somewhat slower.
Because playing, the devil's advocate, I would say this is totally trivial. It's just beating, electron beating in a molecule. What you have in an atom, because you have a width of your excitation pulse, it's arcoseconds. Mm-hmm. It comprises several levels. And of course, some of these levels are located on very different parts of the molecule.
Yes.
And you simply excite them coherently.
Yeah.
So I would say the very interesting part is where the energy gets localized.
Absolutely.
In the end.
Absolutely.
Difficult in theory, maybe it's easier in experiment, I don't know, to find that.
I would say for the moment it's both still quite difficult, but definitely on both sides progress is being made. Eh? So there are the first theoretical treatments now that include these effects, and also there are the first experiments happening right now that begin to probe whether this is actually happening or not. And coming back to your first point of, whether this is trivial or not, I think the novelty compared to how people have been thinking about these processes in the past is that this type of dynamics really contains an element of electronic coherence. And so the excitation of the involvement of multiple electronic states at the same time, and that is very different from, let's say, the Born-Oppenheimer dynamics that people have been used to in the past.
On the other hand, it's not arcosecond it's not time-dependent dynamics. It could be treated in the energy domain completely if it's fully coherent, because it's just the superposition of modes, which,
Yes, in principle, in fact, that's how the early papers were actually done. I mean, they mostly looked at static properties of these molecules, and based on that, predicted what would happen in the time domain.
But, sorry, is it okay? Right? It's just kind of, it's workshop, right? So I would be very interested to learn to understand if you have indications if this relaxation process is split somehow, if kind of goes for a while coherently, and if the final relaxation is also on a very fast time scale, or not, or if this goes kind of smoothly, this localization.
Okay.
I've no idea.
Yeah, I would say for the moment also, I mean, basically to jump ahead a little bit, I mean, I think the experiments that can really answer this don't really exist at the moment, but are on the verge of happening. So I think probably within the next couple of years, these experiments
and what
are really...
what would you do to measure that?
I think that's the interesting discussion, I think. I mean, what should one measure to make it visible? I mean, I think that's...
You have to be able to measure the electrons on the attosecond time scale and nuclei on the femtosecond time scale. They're coupled together.
But I mean, I think that would be a very exciting question to discuss. I mean, like, what should experimentalists try to measure in order to bring out this behavior? I mean, I think there we are. It's as new to us as it is to you, I think. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a little bit motivation. And so now let me come then to the questions that I will try to address today. So the first question that I will try to address is, I mean, can charge migration only be induced by attosecond pulses, or are there perhaps also other ways? I mean, as an experimentalist, that's a very practical question, because clearly you can imagine, based on what I've shown you, I mean, if there is such a very quick charge migration happening in our molecule, then we will want to use our attosecond pulses to probe this, right? That is, in particular, where we want to exploit our attosecond time resolution. But as experimentalists, that for the moment still puts us in a very difficult situation, because an experiment where we use an attosecond pulse to induce charge migration, and where we then use an attosecond pulse, a second attosecond pulse, to probe the charge migration, that is still very, very difficult, because we don't really have the attosecond pulses intense enough for that. So as you know, I mean, all the attosecond experiments, or almost all the attosecond experiments up to now, are two color experiments where attosecond pulses are combined with IR. And it basically means that within an experimental protocol, we can only use our attosecond pulse once. And if we've used it to initiate the charge migration, then we're kind of stuck, then we have to probe it with the IR. And so the question is, can we also induce charge migration in other ways, for example, with infrared light? Then the second question is what I referred to a moment ago. If we want to probe charge migration using attosecond pulses, then how does one actually do this? I mean, what should we look at? I mean, it's not sufficient to be in a laboratory and to have a molecule where charge migration is happening and fire an attosecond pulse at it. We also need a proper observable that tells us that the process that we are interested in is happening. And so, I mean, is that even possible? I mean, to make time-resolved electron dynamics in molecules visible with attosecond pulses, and I'll show some experiments that go that have something to say about that. And then one thing that will show up in this talk is that, I mean, anytime that we are doing an experiment that involves photoionization of a molecule, then at some stage in our experiment we're going to have a photoelectron, we're going to have a molecular ion. Typically, in the way that we think about the experiment, we tend to concentrate on one or the other, and we tend to forget about one or the other. And the question is this really justified? I mean, is it really justified in an attosecond experiment to, at some point in our interpretation, make a split between the photoelectron and the molecular ion? And I will look a little bit at the question, under which conditions correlations between the molecular ion and the photoelectron can remain important. And we've seen some interesting examples of that. Now, and then finally, but that's a bit of a dessert, time permitting, I know there's many people here who are interested in photoionization time delays, and time permitting, which probably will not be the case, I can also show you a few results that provide a little bit an alternative look at photoionization time delays. Okay, but let's start with the first question. I mean, are there alternative ways to induce charge migration in molecules? I mean, other than the use of attosecond pulses the way it was proposed by the theoreticians? And in particular, the question that we have asked ourselves is, can we use strong field ionization with an infrared laser or with a UV laser to induce charge migration? Now, in the literature, there certainly are already results that suggest that that this is the case. Before I show these, maybe first rephrasing the question a little bit. The question can also be asked in the form, I mean, is the single active electron approximation valid in strong field ionization? In other words, if we have a strong field ionization process, do we then purely form the molecular ion in its ground electronic states, as traditionally has been assumed, or are there possibilities to coherently prepare a number of ionic states, which basically is equivalent to saying that we're inducing charge migration, and that we have a time-dependent electron motion that gets initiated. Now, the experiments that have already said something about this a few years ago were experiments done in the group of Paul, where important theoretical work was done by Olga Smirnova and Misha Ivanov. And these are these very well-known experiments that I think many of you have seen before, where high harmonic generation was studied in aligned CO2 molecules. And here you basically see the high harmonic generation spectrum. And so harmonic order here on this axis, and here the molecular alignment axis. And very clearly visible is a kind of interference structure here, which was interpreted in terms of an interference between high harmonic generation involving the HOMO and high harmonic generation involving the HOMO minus one. And so that's basically exactly this situation that we are after. And so I mean, here the high harmonic generation involving the HOMO, here the harmonic generation involving the HOMO minus one, are basically telling us that after the first step of the three-step process, we apparently have produced a coherent superposition of the X and the B state of CO2, and that of course would then be accompanied by a time-dependent motion of the hole in the CO2 plus ion. And so these are results that had been around for some time. And one discussion that I had with Albert Stohler around that time is whether it might be possible to do an experiment that observed this, the formation of this coherent superposition, a little bit more directly than it is the case in this experiment. And because here, of course, we're dealing with a high harmonic generation experiment. It's not just an ionization experiment. I mean, there's the recombination process. There might even be phase matching effects, what have you. There's a lot more happening in this experiment than just the ionization process producing just this lowest ionic state, or perhaps a superposition of multiple of them. And so the question that Albert and I asked ourselves is, how would we do this? I mean, how would we do an experiment that would tell us whether or not in strong field ionization we're forming multiple ionic states? Now, as experimentalists, there are different things that you can think of looking at in your experiment. One thing that we might consider to look at in our experiment is the formation of fragment ions. So again, looking at a mass spectrum similar to what you saw for the Weinkauf experiment. In the sense that, I mean, ground state molecular ions tend to be stable, and the moment that you see fragment ions, that's basically an indication that you've put more energy into the molecule than what's strictly the strict minimum needed to ionize, and that could point then at a population of excited ionic states in the ionization process. However, it doesn't really prove very much, in a sense that the formation of fragment ions in strong field ionization is very, very common, and very commonly it's a sequential process, or it's interpreted as a sequential process where you first form the ground state ion. Once you form the ground state ion, of course, the laser is still on, and there's plenty of opportunity for further absorption of photons that then can lead to fragmentation. And so it doesn't really tell you whether in this initial ionization step, higher excited states were reached. Now, of course, there's another observable. You can choose to look at the photoelectrons that are being produced in this process. And in looking at these photoelectron spectra, you can try to decide whether the photoelectron spectra reflects the presence of more than one ionization potential. Of course, as I think all of you know, I mean, in strong field ionization, the photoelectron spectra are above threshold ionization spectra, so these characteristic comb spectra with a number of peaks separated by one photon, of the energy of one photon. And so you can try and see whether these ATI spectra have the appearance of having multiple ionization potentials involved by looking at shifts between peaks or so. However, that's also not a very satisfying approach, not a very conclusive approach, in the sense that there's many ways that complicated photoelectron spectra can arise in above threshold ionization. And for example, if Freeman resonances are involved, so resonances in the neutral molecule before the ionization takes place, that can actually lead to very similar observations. So what Albert and I decided to do is that really one should look at both of these things at the same time, and then you can come to quite compelling conclusions. And so the idea basically would be to look at the formation of fragment ions and shifted photoelectron peaks in coincidence, or rather what we've done a covariance measurement. So let me explain how that covariance measurement works. I mean, any time that I fire my laser into a molecular sample, so typically it's a molecular beam containing the molecules at some appropriate density, there's going to be a number of ionization events, and I can measure an ion time of flight, which is then basically a measurement of the mass spectrum. And in this measurement, I will probably see that some parent ions are being detected, and probably also I will see that some fragments are being detected. And then the other measurement that I can do, and I can quite easily do this at the same time, for example, on the detector in the opposite direction, is to measure the electron time of flight. And then basically for every ion that I have here, there also will be an electron somewhere in this electron time of flight.
So this is a coincidence?
For the moment, I'm not talking about coincidence. It will be in a moment. Yeah. And so, I mean, this is basically a measurement that I can do single shot. I mean, the nice thing that I can do here in my diagram is that I can color code the electrons that belong to the parent or the fragment. And in the sense that here I've chosen that these five fragment ions leads to these and these electrons, and similarly for the fragments. But there in the laboratory, I encounter a practical problem. That in the laboratory, my electrons don't carry a label whether they belong to a parent or a fragment. But there is one thing that we can do. It's not quite going to be coincidence, but what we can do is that we can repeat this measurement many, many, many times, millions of times. It's quite easy to do. Just based on statistical variations, we will always use an appropriate number of ionization events to optimize this. I mean, there will be shots where there is relatively more fragmentation, and there will be shots where there is relatively more detection of the parent molecular ion. Now, and if there is a correlation between having these fragments in these parents and certain contributions to the photoelectron spectra, then it should be the case that as these fluctuations are happening here, they are mimicked in fluctuations that are happening here. Right? So that basically means by looking at these fluctuations for a long enough time, by doing covariance analysis, we can basically deconvolute the total photoelectron spectrum. We can separate it into contributions corresponding to the parent and contributions corresponding to one or more of the fragments. And so it's not quite a coincidence analysis, but it essentially carries the same information as a coincidence analysis. So that is what we've done for a range of molecules. And here you see results for the butadiene molecule. And so here the mass spectrum is, we see dominant parent mass, also a few fragments that are showing up. And here you see the deconvolution of the total photoelectron spectrum into a photoelectron spectrum accompanying formation of the parent and photoelectron spectra accompanying the formation of various of these fragments. Again, you clearly recognize that it's an ATI spectra, but that's not going to be of interest here. Really, the only thing that I want you to see in this spectrum is that the peaks in the ATI spectrum corresponding to the parent are shifted with respect to the peaks that show up in the fragment spectra. Now, that basically tells us that these fragments are not being formed by a sequential process. I mean, if they are formed by a sequential process, then first the electron is gone and subsequently the fragmentation takes place, then they would have had the same photoelectron spectrum. And so apparently, these fragments predominantly result from ionization events that lead to the formation of excited molecular ions that, as a result of that, more easily fragment.
Is it possible to repeat that? I didn't understand why. If there's the shift?
I mean, so basically what we are trying to decide is whether or not there is a sequential process. I mean, if there was a sequential process, then the logic that we are using is that the photoelectron spectrum accompanying the parent and accompanying the fragment would have been the same. In a sense that this photoelectron flies out and it doesn't know whether or not subsequently we're going to fragment the ion or not. On the other end, what we're seeing here is that the photoelectron spectrum accompanying the fragments is different from the photoelectron spectrum accompanying the parent. So apparently there's something in the ionization process that predetermines whether we are going to see a parent or a fragment. And the way that we interpret it is what predetermines it is, you know, in the photoionization event, we're either going to go to the ground state that is going to give us predominantly these parent ions, or we're going to some excited states. And that makes it much easier to get fragmentation, I mean, with or without further photoabsorption.
I mean, this depends on the time scale also, because people used to study post-collision interaction, I think they have to
remember. Yes, yes.
And there, if a slow electron goes out and the ion rearranges, then that slow electron is affected. So I think this interpretation is predicated on the electron coming out fast.
Yes. No, that's certainly true. I mean, we're in a sense neglecting the, or we're relying on post-collision interactions not being important. But in that sense, it's encouraging that we see these. I mean, that's where it really helps to work with ATI spectra. So this shift, we see it consistently over the entire spectrum.
Why is there a double peak at 6 eV in the blue line?
It's a very good question.
There also 3.5, right? I think that's another frequency here.
I mean, mind you, I mean, the way that I look at these spectra is that we can distinguish whether it's single active electron or not. Obviously, the dynamics between forming multiple ions and eventually having these fragments is very, very complicated, and we can't even rule out that it involves further photoabsorption. And so in that sense, the actual assignment of which ionic states are responsible for the fragments that we see, that's very, very difficult. There may well be multiple ionic states leading to the same fragment.
How intense?
How intense
would you be?
The laser intensity, if I remember correctly, is something like high 10 to the 13. I thought 7 or 8 times 10 to the 13 is right.
Particle bombs, they're referring to the same peak that shifted, or how do I know that?
So basically, you're referring to these lines here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, these lines are basically there to indicate that the shift that we see from one ATI comb to the other, that it's not the energy of one photon. And actually, upon further analysis, we can relate this shift to differences in the ionization potential of the excited states that are probably involved. So we think that this one clearly is related to the ground state molecular ion, and we have very likely candidates for the ionic states that accompany this ionization event, because basically the shift seems to be consistent with the difference in the ionization potential. I mean, it's not definitive, but it at least comes out more or less the way you would expect it. Yes.
Friedman resonances or
different? No, this is not Friedman resonances.
So why not?
If we had a Friedman resonance, then my feeling would be that there's no propensity that would lead to fragment, that would preferentially lead to fragmentation, I would say, if anything, quite on the contrary. Because a Friedman resonance basically means that you're, you know, already more or less forming your molecular ion just with the electron still weakly bound to it, and then further photoabsorption just removes this. And so that's why I was saying on the previous slide photoelectron spectra like this, let's say the superposition of all of these curves, I mean, could lead to quite complicated spectra, certainly if Friedman resonances are involved, but that doesn't really tell you anything yet about whether higher excited states are involved. I would say quite on the contrary. Yeah. Okay, so coming back to this calculation by Setterbaum and what we would like to be able to do in the lab, I mean, that's basically quite good news what we have seen now. So basically what we've seen is an experiment on butadiene and a few other molecules, where on the one hand, we've been able to see that the breakdown of the single active electron, what we would need to be able to initiate the charge migration with IR, that is happening. And at the same time, of course, this measurement that we're now able to do provides us with a relatively easy protocol to actually test whether molecules are a good candidate for this. It's probably not going to be true for every molecule that the single active electron approximation breaks down. But with this ATI measurement, or with this covariance measurement, we can do very rapid screening of molecules that are candidates for charge migration and molecules that are not.
Does it say anything about the coherence between the two electronic states? I
don't think it does. No, it's not measured here. No. And certainly, I think for the long pulses that we have used here, you would also not anticipate that the coherence is there. I would argue if this experiment had been done with a few cycle pulses, then I wouldn't really see how the coherence could be lost. If the ionization is, let's go down really to single cycle, then I wouldn't really see what could remove the coherence. But in the present experiment, certainly not. Okay, so what I now then want to turn to our pump probe experiments, and particular pump probe experiments looking at the question whether we can use attosecond pulses to probe electron dynamics in molecules. Because that is what we would have to be able to do in an experiment where we initiate charge migration with IR and then try to probe it with the XUV. Now, in doing so, I briefly want to summarize what we have done in terms of pump probe spectroscopy so far. So I start with a few slides on the first experiment that we have done on this topic. So basically pump probe experiments in molecules. And the first experiment that we've done actually was an experiment where the XUV was the pump rather than the probe. So that's where the work in hydrogen that we already published a few years ago. I very briefly want to summarize this work because there's one point in this work that I want to draw attention to, which will become important again later in the talk. So very quick summary. In this experiment, we used an attosecond pulse to ionize hydrogen, forming the hydrogen either in the ground ionic state or on this first excited repulsive state. And then at a variable time delay, a few cycle IR pulse was sent into the experiment to basically further influence the experiment. I wouldn't necessarily call it a pump probe sequence because the IR wasn't really probing so much in this experiment, but the IR was certainly influencing the subsequent dynamics. The measurement that we've done is a velocity map imaging measurement on the H plus that is formed in this channel here, so basically the dissociative ionization channel. And velocity map imaging basically means that we take these H pluses that are measured, that are formed in the experiment, and by means of a small electric field, we accelerate them towards a position sensitive detector. And then you get an image that, for example, looks like this. Now, this image is very useful in the sense that based on the applied fields, the time that it takes the ion to travel towards the detector is fixed. That basically means that the position displacement that we see here on the detector is really a velocity measurement. And so we really look at these measurements as measurements of the velocity distribution of the ion. As you can measure the absolute velocity, and as you immediately see here also, you get information about the angular distribution with respect to the polarization axis. And that's also very useful information. Now, that in particular was the information that we used in this experiment, in the sense that in this experiment, we looked at the difference between the propensity for the H pluses to be flying up or down as a function of the time delay between the attosecond pulse and the few cycle IR pulse. And so that basically led to this measurement here. So here you see an asymmetry parameter, which is basically the normalized difference between the number of ions that follow the polarization axis in one direction versus the number of ions that follow the polarization axis in the opposite direction. The normalized difference plotted as a function of the kinetic energy of the H pluses and plotted as a function of the time delay between the two pulses. And what you can clearly see, I mean, the signal to noise isn't great, but what you can clearly see is that there's an oscillation in this asymmetry. And so by changing the delay a slight amount, we can reverse the preferential direction where the H plus is flying out. And of course, I say what we measure is the H plus. The meaning that it really has to us is where the electron is localizing in the system. We are dealing with H2 plus. There's one electron in the system. We measure H plus on one side. It means that the electron is on the other side. Now, as it turns out, there were two mechanisms responsible for this behavior. To understand these mechanisms, we first have to realize what it means to have a localization of the electron. And that is easily recognized by realizing that the two electronic states that are involved in the experiment have wave functions that can be written as linear combination of atomic wave functions. So basically the ground state is a linear combination having the electron either on the left or on the right proton with the plus sign in between. That's a bonding orbital. And the ungerade state, the first excited state, is a similar linear combination but then with a minus sign. Now when you rewrite this a little bit, you can see then what it means to perform a measurement where you find the electron on the left or where you find the electron on the right. It basically means that in one way or another, and that is what our experiment, what we now have to explain, that one way or another, we have put the system in a superposition of the gerade and the ungerade state. And so that is basically what we have to explain. How does our pump probe sequence do this? Now, as it turned out, there were two ways that our pump probe sequence was able to do this. The first way is shown here. That is basically a mechanism where the attosecond pulse ionizes the molecule and launches a wave packet on this repulsive state. Now, when that happens, it's clear that dissociation is inevitable. But if we don't do anything else, in this dissociation, the H plus will be flying to the right as often as to the left. Now, the way that this symmetry gets broken is by an interaction with the IR. And the interaction by the IR basically takes place here in this region, where the repulsive curve and this ground state curve, where they approach each other, and where at some point the gap between the curves is approximately one IR photon. And in that region, transfer of population by the IR from the upper to the lower state is going to be very efficient. And that basically means if we now, far away in our detector, measure one of the H pluses, we don't really know anymore whether we are dealing with a molecule in the gerade state or in the ungerade state. Basically, we are now in the superposition and we measure an asymmetry.
Is it blue line is one or two photons? Is it two photons, the blue line or one?
This photon is basically a one photon ionization by the attosecond pulse. Now, the second mechanism is shown here, and that is actually the reason that I'm showing you these results, in the sense that this is a very intriguing mechanism that we certainly had not anticipated before we started the experiment. This mechanism basically was revealed in close coupling calculations that Fernando Martin did when he helped us to try and explain the result. In this mechanism, you see that there's one additional curve that I've drawn here, this curve labeled Q1. This Q1 state is a doubly excited state of the neutral molecule. And so basically you can think of this Q1 state as a Rydberg state converging on the 2p sigma u excited state. It's an autoionizing state, absolutely, yes. In fact, this autoionization is very important because also along this curve, the molecule is going to dissociate. But you see that basically up to this internuclear distance here, the energy of this state is above the ground state ionic curve, and it basically means that autoionization can take place. And so that basically means that all along this curve, autoionization takes place, and it basically means that we form a wave packet with a very broad kinetic energy distribution with gerade state character. Yeah? Now, as before, we can have the ionization process reaching the ungerade state, this dissociative state that we already encountered, and that also forms a broad dissociative wave packet. So you see, again, we have two pathways giving us a superposition of gerade and ungerade. However, this is where things get a little bit tricky, in the sense that this superposition of gerade and ungerade, at this point, is not a coherent superposition yet. And the reason that it's not a coherent superposition yet is that these two ionization processes, the autoionization going to the gerade state and this direct ionization process going to the ungerade state, are accompanied by different photoelectrons. In one case, the photoelectron has Gerade symmetry. In the other case, the photoelectron has Ungerade symmetry. And so that basically means this is not a coherent superposition. In principle, we could do a measurement on the photoelectron to tell us whether we are dealing with an ion in the Ungerade or in the Gerade state. Now, that is actually where now the role of the IR comes in. In a sense that, I mean, just as it happens in a streaking measurement or as it happens in a rabbit measurement, the IR can interact with the outgoing photoelectron, can change the angular momentum of the outgoing photoelectron. And after this change, the angular momentum of the outgoing photoelectron can become the same as the angular momentum of the photoelectron that we get in the autoionization process. And then the two have become indistinguishable, and then the superposition has become, and it's a coherent superposition. And so that's a very intriguing mechanism where we have an interaction with the IR, with the outgoing photoelectron, that ends up determining where we find the bound electron in our system, because that is really what the H plus measurement is telling us. And so this is really a case where, I mean, depending on your taste of words, where you can say that, you know, correlation between the electrons is important, or maybe even where entanglement of the two parts of the total wave function is important. Now, and this is something that we will again encounter in an experiment that I will discuss a little bit later on. I mean, let's return to the question that we really wanted to ask ourselves, and it's basically whether we can use ultrasecond pulses for probing ultrafast electron dynamics. And there also, our first attempt has been on the hydrogen system. And the reason for this attempt is given by this plot here. This is a plot that was measured while we were working on the electron localization problem. And basically what this plot shows is the kinetic energy distribution, or the velocity distribution rather, of the H pluses that we see as a function of time delay. And so in this case, the vertical axis is not asymmetry, but it's basically the velocity of the H plus. And the horizontal axis is the same time delay axis, time delay between XUV and IR that we already had before. Now, this is quite a busy plot. I mean, it shows many different regions of enhanced intensity, and many of these actually can be understood quite well simply looking by the existing literature on, you know, bond softening, enhanced ionization, and so on and so forth. And so many of these, basically this plot reflects many processes that are very, very well known in the hydrogen literature. But then there's one contribution that is very intriguing, and that is basically that we see that at time overlap, so delta t equals zero is more or less given by this yellow arrow here, at time equals zero here, we see that there's a significant enhancement in the formation of H plus ions with a high kinetic energy. And so that's the moment that we saw that result. I mean, we started asking ourselves, okay, does that reflect that the ultrasecond pulse is probing something that we are doing to the electrons in the neutral molecules? For example, that we are polarizing the molecule a little bit. So that's why we've looked at that in a little bit more detail.
What is the pulse duration of the IR?
Pulse duration of the IR is something like 5 femtoseconds here. So that's why you see that this island is confined to something like, it's basically the overlap region of the two pulses. So that's why we looked at this in a little bit more detail. So further IR XUV pump probe experiments on H2. And what I first show you now are a few images that we have recorded during these measurements. So these images, again, are direct pictures of the velocity distribution that you can get. So this first image is the image that you get if you only send in the ultrasecond pulses, and again gives you a kinetic energy distribution that can quite easily be interpreted. You see some direct ionization to the ground state at this low energy feature here, and you see this broad distribution having to do with direct excitation to the 2p sigma, so this ionization to the repulsive state. And it's filled in by these autoionization processes that we already talked about, which also give a very broad kinetic energy distribution. And now let's see what happens when we bring in the IR, so overlapped in time. And just like in the contour plot that you saw a moment ago, you see now a very big enhancement of this high energy region. And so that's basically consistent with what we've seen up to now. And so now basically what we're going to look at is how the intensity in this outer ring, so that depends on the IR, how this depends on the XUV IR time delay. Now that is basically given by this measurement here. Signal to noise is not great, but I hope you can see that basically as we change the time delay in very small steps, so scanning the ultrasecond pulse over the IR cycle, then there's actually an oscillation in this high kinetic energy distribution. And so in that sense, that's nice. I mean, that could mean that the ultrasecond pulse is instantaneously probing something that the IR is doing to the molecule. We can go one step further. We can, again, make a comparison between experiment and theory. So again, these are calculations by Fernando Martin. And indeed, in these calculations also, you very clearly see the modulation of the formation of these high kinetic energy fragments as you're scanning a few cycle IR pulse over the ultrasecond pulses. But fortunately, this doesn't really tell us yet what is happening. I mean, it's one thing that we can measure it or that we can calculate it. But what does this now all say about the role of electron dynamics in the experiment?
And the oscillation that you observe in the theory is not the same. Is it shifted compared to the experiment?
I mean, the time axis that we have here, these are all relative axes. Of course, because in the calculation, they know very well what the relative time delay is. Experimentally, we don't really know that.
And the pulse duration.
In principle, that ought to be similar. I agree. I also see the difference. In principle, that ought to be similar. I would have to check the parameters that were used in this particular calculation. But in principle, we would not expect to see a difference in that period. So, I mean, in order to get hopefully a little bit better understanding of what is actually happening here, we've made a very simple model. And it's basically a model where we keep the internuclear distance between the two atoms in the H2, where we keep this fixed. I mean, that's probably not a very bad approximation, since anyway, this is an experiment that is over very quickly. At least the ionization part of the experiment is over very quickly. Okay, so we can look at different possibilities in this, using this fixed nuclei approximation. I mean, the first is we can try and analyze the experiment in terms of essentially a rabbit-like experiment. And so as many of you know, I think, I mean, a rabbit is a technique where you have an ionization threshold and you look at the ionization process through resulting from the combination of having harmonics and transitions of the continuum electron by the induced by the IR, and then in particular interferences between these downward and these upward transitions involving different harmonics. And so one way we could look at the experiment is to say, okay, we have our ground ionic state. I mean, that has a rabbit-like experiment. We have the excited ionic state. I mean, there a rabbit-like experiment is occurring, and maybe that explains what we are seeing. Now, this we can calculate, and in this picture, basically, we wouldn't expect any modulation of the H plus yield as a function of time. In a way, it also really makes sense that in a rabbit experiment, what the IR is doing, it's redistributing the electrons in the continuum. But it's not really changing how many of these electrons we are making. So in that sense, it's not so surprising that we don't reproduce the oscillation in this picture. Now, then of course, we've already used that before. We know that these two electronic states are coupled by the IR. So we can also calculate this through taking this coupling into account. And then indeed, we start to see oscillations in the H plus yield as a function of delay. However, we now really overestimate the oscillations as a function of time. Now, that's not so surprising because, of course, this coupling we can't really do in the absence of the rabbit-like couplings that I showed a moment ago. So really, to do it properly, we would have to have all these couplings at the same time. And then, indeed, we reproduce rather well what we see in the complete quantum calculation that Fernando has done. And so now the shapes of the closed coupling calculation, that's the black dotted line, and the simple model is the gray line here. The shapes match quite well. There's a little time offset between the two, but that's also something that we wouldn't necessarily expect to come out correctly of our simple model. And so the conclusion is basically that the coupling between the 1s sigma g and the 2p sigma u, so this coupling here, that is very important. We know that this coupling is accompanied by a polarization that occurs in the ion. So basically having the superposition of these two moves the charge a little bit in one way or in the other way. And apparently the ionization process with the altosecond pulse is sensitive to this polarization. Yes.
This coupling, is this on this, is it adiabatic as the IR, or does it have its own time scale, so to speak?
I guess I don't fully understand the question.
Does it just follow?
I mean, basically we apply it.
Does it show its own internal time scale?
Within this model, it follows instantaneously. Yeah. I mean, whether that's realistic or not, I don't know. Maybe that's also where the shift is coming from. Within the simple model, it's instantaneous. However, returning to the question that we had asked ourselves at the beginning, can we use attosecond pulses to see time-dependent electron dynamics in neutral molecules? Then it's clear that this experiment hasn't really done that. In the sense that here we have seen interesting time-dependent dynamics, but if anything, this dynamics is all happening in the ion. We haven't had to assume any dynamics in the neutral in order to explain this result. So it's interesting, but it's not what we were after.
Mark, isn't yes. that very similar to the early experiments in helium under Ye, just one electron?
No.
Opposed to an attosecond pulse train, that's really different.
That's really, really different, yes. In the sense that, if you recall the explanation of that experiment, was basically population of bound states prior to ionization and basically interferences.
Well, what is a bound state in IR, a highly excited bound state?
Basically,
bound ionized in a molecule in a very short time scale.
Yeah, but I think, the key difference here is that, that's an experiment that was explained basically in terms of, one single ionic state, so basically the ground ionic state of the helium atom, whereas here it's really essential that we have this coupling between the two ionic states that the hydrogen has.
But I would argue it's simply two electronic states. I don't care where they come from in a way, because it's all sculptured by the light pulses, the XUV plus the... You need one electron, right? You need one electron, or you need a diagnostics, which is the ion or the ionized state.
Yes.
And I think that's at least very similar to the atom. You just need one electron. You need to be, let's say, close to whatever the ionization threshold is. That's true, because for argon you didn't see anything, it was high up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I could imagine that one difference is you have a single XUV, right, pulse.
No, this was done with an attosecond pulse train.
It's a train,
Okay, I would have to think. I haven't tried to map one situation on the other, and for the moment I don't immediately see how it could be done, but I'd have to think about it.
Well, because I would argue this time experiment doesn't tell you a lot about the target. It tells you a lot about the continuum or this near threshold behavior of an electron in this, superposition of two light pulses. And it would be flat if there would be nothing in between, but your ionization threshold gives you an observable which discriminates what you said a little bit between bound and ionization. That makes a nice pattern.
I'm not sure. What I would tend to say, I may be wrong, but what I would tend to say is that in this little model that, as we see, quite successfully explains the experiment, the precise location of these ionization thresholds and whether we are operating near threshold or not, as far as I can tell, doesn't play a role. And I think that would make it different from... it's really the coupling between these two states that is the key aspect of the experiment, and whether you introduce this coupling, let's say, close to the threshold, or whether you do this somewhere much higher up, as far as I can tell, in this model and in this experiment, would not make a difference.
I think if you go very high above threshold, you won't have a modulation anymore. That must be true here as well.
I'm not sure. I mean, the way that we think about the experiment, I would anticipate that also higher up, we would still see this effect.
Okay.
I mean, we haven't done it. We haven't calculated through, but I would anticipate that we would see it almost the same as we have seen it here. Could be tried. Okay, so the next attempt that we have made to see this probing of electron dynamics by ultrasecond pulses is basically to go to a little bit bigger molecule, to go to the nitrogen molecule. I mean, otherwise the experiment has been relatively similar. So again, what we've measured are fragment ion kinetic energy distributions as a function of time delay. So in this particular case, an N plus kinetic energy distribution as a function of time delay. And what you recognize here, you see many, many oscillations. Clearly, these experiments, again, have been done with the train of ultrasecond pulses rather than isolated ultrasecond pulses. You see that this kinetic energy distribution is quite structured and actually has many components separated by a very small amount of energy, a small fraction of an EV. Now, that's not very surprising, and that has been seen many times in the photoionization of nitrogen, and basically points to involvement of the C state here. So the C state of N2 plus is a metastable state, and it basically means that in an experiment you can quite easily see predissociation of vibrational levels that you've initially formed in the laser excitation, and that's basically where all these lines can be assigned to vibrational levels that predissociate here.
Question.
May I ask you what does it mean? This is I-Eric human pump probe, and then the x-axis you wrote XCB. Do you have the name?
Yeah, it's two colors. We would hope to think of this experiment as IR pump XUV probe, but we have to see. I mean, it could also be in that the observable that we have here, that is more the other way around. That is an XUV ionization and then modulated by the IR. I would say that's a little bit semantics. We don't really know. I mean, that's what we need to determine now, what we have actually done here in this situation. So we see these oscillations in the yield of various of these kinetic energy distributions as a function of delay. And this actually turns out to be very interesting in the sense that when we take a little bit closer look, then we see that various of these oscillations are really not in phase at all. And that there's a phase slip across these peaks. And that you can see quite easily in this blow up here. And so here you have the oscillations in the 0.5 EV. peak, that's so this one here, and here slightly higher up at 0.83 EV, so that's this one here, I think, you see that the oscillations are almost exactly out of phase with what we have below. So that clearly points that there's something going on that is different from the hydrogen experiment that I talked about just now, because in the hydrogen experiment, basically all the kinetic energy contributions that we have in the H+, they all oscillate in phase. Here, apparently, as a function of kinetic energy, there are quite dramatic changes. Now, the analysis of this experiment is not fully completed yet. I mean, this work is also not published yet. But the tentative explanation is that we have two mechanisms here that cause the behavior that we see. So the oscillations as a function of time, and also the dependence on the vibrational level that we see as a function of time. The first of these mechanisms is quite simple. We think that it's a rabbit-like mechanism. And so that basically means that in the photoionization, forming these vibrational levels in the C state, we can have interferences between XUV plus IR and XUV minus IR transitions, and that then basically manifests when long after the experiment, these states predissociate. So that is not so surprising. But then, there has been a second observation that I should have pointed out to you. So I've pointed out that the oscillations on these fringes, that they are not in phase with each other, that sometimes they're actually almost completely out of phase when from one peak to the next. Moreover, what I should have pointed out is that there's very interesting behavior in the contrast of these fringes as a function of time delay. The zero time delay here in this measurement is determined from an atomic experiment, so basically from a rabbit experiment that really allows us to nail down the time zero quite accurately. And what you see is that the optimum or the largest contrast in these fringes really is observed away from zero at a delay of something like 15 or 20 femtoseconds.
Which one is first? Which direction?
For reasons that are not entirely clear to me, the PhD student has chosen to plot this in a way that negative time delay means that the XUV comes first. I've asked him to change this already. it's not the most intuitive way to plot it, I think.
XUV is a train of autoseconds.
Yes, yes.
How many do you have pulses in the
train? About 20 or so, I think, in this particular case. Yeah, it's a relatively long train. I mean, you see this overlap region is something like 30, 40 femtoseconds or something.
So this is actually overlapping.
Yes. But we see that the maximum fringe contrast is observed when the peak of the IR comes quite a bit after the peak of the XUV, something like 15 or 20 femtoseconds. Yeah. Now, that actually leads us to the second mechanism that we think is happening. In the sense that we think we are looking at an interference between fragments that are formed directly in a two-color process and fragments that are formed in a sequential process, where the sequential process then involves the C state, and that is then basically, again, why we see these striped kinetic energy distributions. So that is sort of sketched here. So we think that, in the end, all the fragments that we see go to this asymptote here. So we think they come out moving along the D state of N2 plus. And we think that we have two ways of going to the D state. One is a direct two-color process. So basically that's a two-photon transition mediated by the B state. The B state has a very large cross-section and is also strongly coupled to the D state. So that's a very efficient way to form the D state in a direct process. And we think that this process is interfering with the sequential process. So that's basically the photoionization, the well-known photoionization forming the C state that then at some delay, something like half a vibrational period or so, is followed by stimulated emission by the IR. So basically where the IR de-excites the C state and dumps the wave packet on the D state.
So you are measuring the ions which are dissociated? Or?
Yes, yes.
Okay, but then dissociation limit is this dash. No, where's the dissociation limit now?
Dissociation limit is here.
Because yeah, I mean, so arrow goes into the boundary region, that's why I was a little bit surprised.
What I wanted to indicate is basically where the Frank-Condon region is. We have a vibrational wave packet, so we actually have quite high kinetic energy, but the Condon point for the IR transition is somewhere here.
Just a moment. Is there an intersection or just between C and D? Seems it's an intersection or just avoided crossing.
It's, as far as I know, it's an avoided crossing. Yes.
Can you comment on the timescales? Just, this looks like a 10 femtosecond, this offset of the maximum.
Yes. So we think
this fits with the.
More or less. More or less the vibrational period of the C state, I think, is something like 30, 40 femtoseconds. So it's basically a half vibrational period, more or less. I'd say at the intensities that we use, I can't really rule it out, but so far we have not had to invoke it in the explanation of the experiment. Of course, what we always try to do is come up with the simplest explanation that is able to reproduce the experiment. Whether that covers all the things that are happening is hard to be sure. But so far in the explanations that we've had to use, we have not had to use Raman processes yet. So far, all the processes that we are considering are linear in the IR. Now, what is so intriguing about this sequential mechanism is that it is a mechanism that mixes, in a sense, the coherence properties of the initial photoionization. So initially, we're ionizing into multiple ionic states, and there's a certain coherence between these states, or certain phases associated with this this ionization process. And then secondly, there is vibrational dynamics that is important in the experiment, and there's phases that are accumulated there as the molecule is vibrating. And as we'll see in a moment, that both of these phases actually play a role in determining what we see experimentally. So let's try and understand that a little bit more. And for this, I first want to show a few formulas of how we how we think about the formalism that underlies this. And so the way that we think about the experiment is that we have a total wave function, which contains a part related to the molecular ion and a part related to the photoelectron. And so that basically means that our wave function we can write as a sum over electronic states of the ion, where each electronic state is accompanied by a vibrational wave packet, and each electronic state is accompanied by a photoelectron wave packet. Yeah. What is then important to realize is that this is the wave function that we are initially exciting with our autosecond pulse or with our two-color excitation. But this basis of electronic states, so the various electronic states of the molecular ion, that is typically not the basis where we will be making our measurements. And so, for example, in this particular case that we're talking about now, what we are measuring is an N plus kinetic energy distribution. And that's and that's in a way taking measurement in a very different basis compared to this molecular ionic state basis that we have here. Of course, all of these ionic states are feeding in to this basis in a sense. But it means that we have to think about how this initial excitation that is best described in terms of molecular states, how it maps onto, let's say, the basis where we do our measurement, which is the fragment ion basis. And so that basically means that the wave function that we're dealing with, we also can write in terms of the basis where we are taking our measurements. And that would then be a basis where we say, okay, our fragments are in a particular electronic state that typically we will not measure in our experiment. So typically this is something that we would incoherently sum over. Now then, again, there is a vibrational part that's now in the continuum, but essentially that's just a vibrational part. And then, as before, there's a photoelectron part here. And also for the photoelectron part, I would say that typically this is something that we don't measure. I mean, we could do coincidence measurements trying to get at that. But for example, in the measurement that we show right now, this part is completely, it's not measured at all. We only look at the properties of the ions as a function of delay. So what that means for what we measure is that, we measure basically the projection of this initial wave function that we excite onto this measurement basis, and then basically integrating over the degrees of freedom of the electron, and to the extent that that is relevant, summing over the electronic states of the ion. And so this is something that we can write out, in terms of two terms, one where the electronic states on the left and the right is the same, and one where this is not the case. And that basically brings out then here an interference term. And in this interference term, we can recognize both the effect of the vibrational propagation, that is going to be important, and so the vibrational propagation accompanying different electronic states of the ion, and here photoelectron wave packets accompanying different states of the molecular ion. And so what is clearly expressed by this is that we have here an overlap of two photoelectron wave packets, and whether or not those photoelectron wave packets overlap determines whether we can see an interference between these vibrational wave packets. And so you see that's exactly the same as what we encountered before in the hydrogen. In the hydrogen, we needed an interaction with the infrared light in order to make the two photoelectron wave packets overlap. And once the IR had made these two photoelectron wave packets overlap, the vibrational wave packets could interfere, and we could see the localization on the light, on the right or on the left. And so that's why really these two parts of the total wave function, why they are really important, and why we should be very careful not to think separately in terms of ionic wave functions and photoelectron wave functions. And so what I'll show you now are some simple calculations, I mean, for this nitrogen system, showing then how both the phases associated with the vibrational propagation and the phases associated with the photoemission, with the photoelectron, how they both play a role in establishing the kinetic energy distribution that we measure. So a little bit about the calculation. I mean, it should probably be obvious how we do it. So basically we run wave packets on two pathways. I mean, one pathway is this direct two-color population of the D state. So that's basically where we have an XUV transition to the B state, and then a transition from the by the IR from the B state to the D state. And the second pathway is where the XUV launches a wave packet on the C state, and where, at a variable time delay, the IR de-excites the molecular ion and basically dumps the wave packet from the D state, from the C state to the D state. And then we let them interfere in the end. Okay, so let me show you the results of these calculations. The first calculation that I'm showing you here is a calculation where we add the contributions from the two pathways, from the direct pathway and the indirect pathway with the vibrational motion in between, where we add them incoherently. And when we add them incoherently, we see this behavior here, where, remarkably, there's already a time dependence. You wouldn't necessarily expect that. Huh? I mean, if you have an incoherent addition of these two pathways, the reason for that is, of course, that in the direct pathway, there is already a rabbit-like interference. So in this case, I mean, we have the incoherent addition of the sequential path, which is essentially entirely smooth, which does not have a dependence or that does not have a rapid dependence on XUV IR delay. However, in the direct path, as so this two photon excitation to the D state via the B state, there we already have rapid like interferences. That's in a way very similar to the H2 experiment that I showed you. It will show up in a moment here. I cut this figure in three parts this morning. Yes, I'm almost done. This is what we get when we have the when we make a coherent addition. That sort of basically means that now we add up the two pathways coherently with a zero relative phase for the initial ionization event. And I hope you can see that there's really quite pronounced differences between these interference patterns. I mean, we see an increase in the fringe contrast here that is quite pronounced. And in addition to that, if you look carefully, we also see that that there are slight shifts in the positions of the peaks in the kinetic energy distributions that appear, which now no longer really have the meaning of vibrational energies. Actually, the energies get shifted up and down a little bit as a result of the interference. And the other thing that I wanted to show you is...
I would say that even if there's not so much difference, I'm surprised that there's not more difference. I mean, quantitatively, it's really the same, right? Just the contrast is a bit more, or am I wrong? No, the second versus the first.
I mean, let me give you the honest answer. I mean, the difference is not as big as I would have hoped. And the reason that the difference is not as big as I would have hoped is because there is already this rabbit-like interference in the initial.
So the major source is basically from the direct channel interference.
I'm not sure if it's the major source, but at least it's comparable amounts. that's certainly true. So in that sense, in an experiment, one would have to try and design it in such a way that interference is removed from the experiment, because that's in a way a background that's a bit annoying at the moment. Okay, this is what we get when we change the relative phase in the initial ionization event. And especially here, when you look at these lineouts here, you can see that then really there should be measurable differences in the interference patterns that you can see. And so the main conclusion here is that.
You could change it so it completely damps out the interference, right? If you just make to cancel it, if you phase it out by, is that unfeasible?
Yeah, you see here as a function of delay, right? I mean, sort of what is possible. I mean, completely damping out, I don't think we see that happening here.
No, we don't. But if you just arbitrarily change the phase, or I guess this could tell you what kind of interesting process to look for, right? Mm-hmm. If you would have a delayed process, which is delayed basically by half a period or something mm-hmm. like that, yeah. then I think you would get an almost flat spectrum.
I'm not so sure.
The incoherent completion would be always there.
Yeah. The direct one is always okay.
I mean, basically, the important thing to emphasize is basically that what you measure here is an interference pattern, and that of course means that it's sensitive to the relative phase between the two pathways. And the important thing is that this relative phase contains a contribution from the photoionization and a contribution from the vibrational dynamics. So basically, from both of them.
And the red curves and the purple one, these are the two pathways, or not?
That's basically here at some arbitrary position in the interferogram, basically looking along these lines here.
Oh, okay.
It's somewhat arbitrary where they are positioned. Mm-hmm. But it does bring out that you know this photoionization phase definitely can have quite a big influence on the interferogram. Okay. I'm still at the question, and let me very quickly go through this last experiment, and then I will stop. I will not show you everything that I prepared. In the sense that we still haven't done this, huh? I mean, we've seen a few interesting experiments now, but we still haven't seen that we can use attosecond pulses to probe time-dependent electron dynamics in molecules. Also, this nitrogen experiment turned out to reveal quite different behavior. So the last experiment that I want to show you is where we've made one more attempt in this direction. And this time we've rephrased the question a little bit. We've asked the question, I mean, can we use attosecond pulses to measure the polarization that is induced in molecules by an IR field? And the reason that we've posed the question in this way is because we've been convinced for a long time that this is actually something that we are able to do. And so in the laboratory, in many of the experiments that we do, we make use of dynamic alignment, which basically means that we make use of experiments where we expose molecules to moderately strong IR fields. What we see then time and again is that this leads to a reorientation of the molecular frame to the polarization axis of the laser. And the way that we think about this process is that with the IR field, we're inducing a dipole in this in the molecule, and this dipole likes to be along the laser polarization axis. And so in that sense, we've been convinced for decades probably that we can induce time-dependent electron dynamics in molecules. So the basic means that the question we've now asked, I mean, is this something, when we are aligning molecules in our laboratory, is this something that attosecond pulses can detect? Is this something that attosecond pulses can see? So what I want to show you here now first are some calculations that were done on this by Frank Lepine, again for the nitrogen molecule. And so here you see the time-dependent electric field, the dipole that is induced in the molecule as a result of this. And most importantly, what Frank has also calculated is the predicted time-dependent variation in the total ionization yield that results from this. And so that is now going to be the difference in what we will do in our experiment. I mean, up to now, we've always looked at molecular fragmentation processes, and there we've had great difficulty finding evidence for the attosecond probing of electron dynamics. What we're now going to look at, based on this calculation here, are time-dependent variations in the total ionization yield. So the sum of all parent ions plus all fragment ions. So here in the case of nitrogen, quite pronounced oscillations are anticipated. One thing where we have to be a little bit careful is that this is a calculation for aligned molecules. And what you see here in this calculation is that, of course, this behavior is expected to be quite alignment dependent. In fact, here you also see a calculation for anti-aligned molecules. Also there, a time-dependent variation is anticipated, but it's actually out of phase with the variation that we have for aligned molecules. So in that sense, I mean, so far the experiment that we've done was with isotropic molecules, and it means that probably within our experiment there has been a lot of averaging over all different orientations. A much better experiment would actually start from aligned molecules. Okay, but here's the result that I wanted to show you. And so what we've done experiments for nitrogen, CO2, and ethylene, And what you see here as a function of infrared XUV time delay are oscillations in the total ionization yield for nitrogen, CO2, and ethylene, showing quite clearly the behavior that we were looking for. And so this, I would say, is the first indication that we have that we can indeed use ottosecond pulses as probes for time-dependent charge dynamics in molecules. And with that, we can briefly come back to this picture. We've seen that if we're interested in doing charge migration, that we can induce charge migration with infrared light, that we can potentially probe it with ottosecond pulses based on this last experiment. And so in that sense, I'm relatively optimistic that it makes sense to go on in this direction. We have some initial experiments in this direction. I will leave that out because then the talk will be too long. But just thank you for your attention.
The last X-ray mark that you described, is this sort of complementary to the experiments with respect to inducing polarization to see in the high harmonic generation during alignment, rotational alignment taking place, and then there is this femtosecond pulse or a few femtosecond pulses, they create the harmonic generation from it.
Mm-hmm.
That is due to the polarization of the molecular electron. Otherwise, there is no harmonic
generation. Yes. So what is your question?
So my question is that you are looking at the ionization channel, whereas electrons are ionized and they have total ionization channel. But the same polarization is also seen indirectly or not directly in ionization in the harmonic generation channel. So is it just a complementary way of looking at this polarization that has been induced by the alignment and the electronic motion that is seen in the harmonic generation as
opposed to ionization? Honest answer is that I'm not sure, in the sense that I'm not. But there's certainly a lot of experts here who know this much, much better. I'm not sure to what extent polarization of the molecule has been taken into account in these
images. Are you doing tunneling with you, or you get
No, no, no. We don't ionize. Huh? We simply polarize the molecule. We don't ionize.
So you're at much lower intensity.
Yeah, it is at something like 10 to the 13 or so. We try not to ionize the molecule here.
Well, 10 to the 13 can have harmonic
One of your last slides here, you talked about, you said that we use the XUV probe ion polarization. Isn't this at the second transient absorption scheme? I mean, isn't that scheme doing that already?
Yeah. No, I think that's a valid point. I mean, I think you could make the argument that those measurements are measuring that as well.
Yeah, I mean, of course, then you have this like sharp migration, larger dipole maybe, because it's slashing, the electrons are slashing larger distances and so on.
Yeah.
But you will never see, I mean, you'll never see this. It's such an experiment. It's a dipole.
But you should, another experiment that you can show this up, is just measure the asymmetry in the ionization time dependent on a second time scale and see where the electron is. I mean, we've predicted this. You just take just time of one sigma G, one sigma U. The phase changes in function of time, the electron is on the left or on the right.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have an attosecond pulse you ionize.
Yeah, but that's a superposition. I mean, he's talking about just polarizing the molecule. I guess.
But
that's the same.
If you look at the polarization of the excited states, very often it's opposite to the ground state polarization.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a different superposition of electronic states.
These problems get large field areas.
Yeah.
So the field will affect this. Well, I put it in those kind of experiments. That's a fried, which is I think a coffee today at 3:15, there should be plenty to discuss.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.